My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I carry my assistant, George W., with me to provide water. And when it's summertime, he provides lemonade, but I'm a little bit of a sore throat. I've had it for 3 years. I started to worry about it a little. But I'm glad to be here. I listened to Jim talk about his resentment, and I happen to have stumbled onto the reason for that resentment. He resented me, if that's possible for you to believe. For something I don't remember ever saying or doing. It just seems to me that anyone who resents me is just a guy who wants to get in the majority. And I want Jim to know that I forgive him for resenting me. Because we've been out here a lot of years. Now, this is my 29th trip out here at Christmas. And I first came out here 28 years ago. Now, does that sound funny? How can you be out here 28 years later on your 29th trip? I'll explain why that is. I can see newcomers going. You come out here once, and you come out here next year, that's a year later, the end of the first year, but that's your second trip out. And your third trip. Now that we've got that, let me tell you about the steps. We have 12 steps. But this is really kind of nice. I'll tell you, this is about the way the meeting looked probably the fourth year, Jim, when we came out here. We said, oh, isn't that nice? We had a whole room full. And it was really nice, and it really is very peaceful. It's nice that this night falls on Christmas Eve and on a rainy Christmas Eve, and all the decent people are home with their families. And only the neurotic misfits are fighting their way through the weather to try to get out there. I don't know why, but we've got to. Otherwise, we may have to love our neighbor. So we're all here and safe and sane and sober, and I hope we'll be here a long time. Some of the people who were here when I first came out here are dead, and a couple are drunk, and but Jim led that meeting 28 years ago on Christmas Eve that year, too. Some of you may not remember why I was invited. He said he could not get a decent speaker on Christmas Eve. All the good speakers were doing other things and home with their loved ones. And so I came out here, and there's the basement of the American Legion Hall. There were about 13 or 14 mopes just sitting around. And the American Legion had decorated their basement. It looked hideous and green and an old tired Christmas tree. And it was like a veteran of World War II itself. And I gave a talk, and I was feeling a little, I thought, I'd never been out this far before, and I thought, Jesus, I'm so far out. Huh. Must have had a stomach cramp, huh? I'm so far out in the country, I could talk just how I feel. Nobody will ever know. So I told him what I thought, how crappy Christmas was. I was living alone, I was living dreadful living in a sleazy little place, and at least it was inside, but it wasn't very good, and I didn't have anything going for me, and my Christmas was over when I sent some presents to my kids about a week before that. That was the end of my Christmas, and I thought people who celebrated Christmas were a bunch of sentimental fools, and I just hated the whole concept of Christmas, and I'm glad there were people in AA on Christmas Eve, because people who are in churches or in their homes were absolutely full of crap. Now, you wouldn't think that would win anyone's heart, would you? But they couldn't wait to hit up to me after the meeting. Will you talk again next year? And I thought, well, that's fair. But I thought about that later. It really told you something about the West Covina group, more than, because I was new and sick, but they were old. And so little by little, we've been here all these years. And I was sitting there thinking tonight, but it's always heartening in a way. 30 years ago this Christmas, 30 years ago tonight, it's nice to have things like Christmas Eve or or your birthday. Those are things you can remember what you were doing. I remember 30 years ago tonight, I was sober. And I was living in an abandoned car at the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, back to the AA club. It was cold and kind of rainy that night. And I went to a meeting at the AA club. And then after the meeting, they closed the club early. Usually it kept open at 1 o'clock. So they said everybody wanted to get home for Christmas. And I was feeling terribly sad because I've always been a terrible sentimentalist. And I have, like many other people, I have the tendency sometimes when I'm being overly sentimental to yearn to have memories of things that never were, but it seems they were. And I thought, Jesus, I've been sober now for almost 60 days. And I've been sober this long since I was forced to be in the insane asylum, and never before that. Wouldn't it be terrible tonight to get thinking about what a hideous night this is and get drunk? And yet I was too cold, and I couldn't sleep in that car. I felt too sad. I was cold and lonely. Someone had slipped me a couple of $2 or $3 at the meeting to go get something to eat. So I thought, what in the world could I do on Christmas Eve to keep from having every good intention goof? I'm saying, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. And I walked down Fairfax Avenue to Cantor's Delicatessen. And I thought, well, nobody in Jewish delicatessen says Merry Christmas. And I went in there and sat and got a paper and drank coffee and had a little snack and sat there most of the night. And nobody said Merry Christmas once. It's just a funny thing. I went back some certain month. I felt pretty good. I went back to my car and went to sleep and was ready to go for the noon Christmas meeting. That wasn't Christmas. And I felt a little bad because I'd just been fired as a janitor. A guy named A had hired me as a janitor. He'd fired me on Christmas Eve as a little touch of class. And he didn't pay me. He was going to pay me next week. I guess he was afraid I might buy myself a present. That goof. Well, I put a terrible curse on him, I'll tell you. And just 24 years later, he died. Well, that isn't so bad. Christmas before that, maybe I told you I'm a sentimentalist. I want things to be just right. I was working in Dallas. I got a job in Dallas. I had a wife and a bunch of little kids in El Paso. And they didn't have much money, but I'd been saving money. And I called them up. I said, don't bother getting any presents because I will be there. And we're going to have a wonderful Christmas. And it's going to be wonderful. I came home on the train on Christmas Eve morning, got there in the afternoon, about noon, I guess. And my wife and all these little children, they were excited. And I said, I'm going down to get some presents. And you have the kids asleep. In the morning, they're going to find under that tree something they've never seen. And so I went down. I was going to get a present, and the guy yelled at me. He said, hey, Clancy, how are you doing in Dallas? I said, fine. Come and have a beer. He said, no, not on Christmas Eve. He said, just one. Well, no more. I went and had a beer. I said, that's all. I got to go shop. He shot at the door, and the bartender said, hey, when you moved to Dallas, you cost me a lot of business. Have one more on me. Just one. Well, I remember being in New Mexico drinking martinis. I don't know what the hell I was doing there. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, and the guy was saying, where's your money, you son of a bitch? I was sitting in a bar in Juarez. The guy served me another Cuba Libre. And I had no money to pay for it. And I had no presents. And I got quite cross with the guy. Don't scream at me. I don't know what I said. And the guy said, next thing I recall, he didn't even take his arm off the bar. He just knocked me right up. Well, that was the total loss I got out of paying for that drink. And I fell on the sidewalk and I cut a big hole in my head and I lay there. And I guess some people came by that knew me because I'd been a little bit of a good guy one time there. And they picked me up and took me home. They knew where I lived and opened the door and pushed me in the door, shut the door and left. Having that, I guess I crawled as far as I could and fell asleep and swallowed the blood. And the next morning, about 6:30, there was a terrible cacophony of sound, and I looked up, there were my children, little girls, all. And there I was. There was something under the tree they'd never seen. And their daddy in a pile of blood. And I tried to explain to them there had been a mix-up. I also tried to tell them something else that I heard a guy say. That sounded good to me. I said, "Daddy's sick." And they didn't go for that either. I don't blame them. That's the kind of Christmas that I've had. A couple of Christmases. The Christmas before that, these Christmases were, I got on a kind of a bad roll there for a while. Christmas before that, I was at the Texas State Insane Asylum. Dorothy in a Christmas pageant that I've described many times. They saw in my record that I had directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. So as I was in there as a suicide and a schizophrenic, after I came off shock treatments and I was become a little more flexible, go this way. They said, "Would you like to direct the Christmas pageant?" It was not quite as complex as an Italian opera. It was about as a second grade level so the whole student body could follow along. I was wondering, some of that come on them. As I said many times, the director's main job was not trying to get to discuss motivation. It was trying to, during the rehearsals, trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary who thought to get Jesus. Get back, Lamar! And I spent a Christmas in the naval ward for emotionally upset people. I spent Christmases in all. I don't know where the hell the Christmases were that I yearned for. Because Christmas has been crappy as far back as I can remember. The last good Christmas, I guess I was 8. And my dad took me home in my sled in the snow, and I wanted a pony and didn't get it for many years. And I wish to Christ I'd never gotten it. I was out in the rain. I had a few dreary newcomers that came by my house today in the rain. They don't know it when it's raining. Just, step in here. These newcomers and I took the wheelbarrow, and we followed the path of that horse. It would rain, and we picked up horsey poo, and the horse smirked at us and laughed, and went back to where we just came up, and and not only that, but a guy named Ken, who's a friend of ours, just bought that horse a lovely little fur jacket to wear on cold days, and we didn't have any, so the horse was great, and we were cold and sick. I want to thank this group for that horse. The horse cost me literally thousands of dollars in hay and straw and vitamins and carrots and doing nice things for people I can suck in to help me clean that stall. It was nice. But the last good Christmas I had was maybe 8 or 9, waiting for my Aunt Alma and Uncle Vern to come down on the tree. It's always been a shimmering thing. Christmas was never approached that. And the trouble with Christmas for me is that all I want out of Christmas is what they seem to promise you, and it seems that everyone else may be having. And it took me a great many years and almost cost me my life to discover that it really is an illusion. That probably occasions such as tonight are one of the great lethal moments for people like me, and I presume like most of you, because I have a combination of circumstances in my life and in my makeup that make it imperative for me to stay reasonably comfortable most of the time. Ever stop and think about that? That is the curse of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know what they make you do here? They make you stay reasonably comfortable most of the time. Isn't that a terrible thing to ask?
Oh, goddamn AA! Go through all that crap!
Because they make you have to be reasonably comfortable. You don't realize that's the case, but that's what it is. And I, like most of you, I'm sure like many of you, when I was in the nut house in Texas, I knew about AA. I'd been going to AA off and on for 7 years. When I was in, came home with the money and stayed drunk all night in Juarez, I'd been around AA 8 years. When I came to Los Angeles and walked 71 blocks off Skid Row on Halloween 1958, I'd been around AA 9 years. And I didn't have the slightest conception that Alcoholics Anonymous could help me. Because of one major, terrible difference between me and them. And I'm sure if you're new tonight, there's a residual part of this in you. I am not like them because my problem is not really alcohol. It is kind of. I can talk jail. I've been in jail 30-some times. I've been in a veterans hospital. I've been in city hospitals. I've been in state insane asylums. I've lost everything. I've lost my home, my family. I've had my front teeth kicked out. I'm living on the street. But I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. I wish I were something that simple, that uncomplex, that type of thing that could be redressed by such a thing as stopping drinking. I discovered when I was a boy and when I was a teenager and when I was in my 20s and I was in my 30s, they got worse each decade. There's something different about me. My emotions don't come together quite right. They do, but not the way other people's do. I have intense feelings. Maybe it's because I want things to be right and other people don't care. Maybe it's because I would like things to be good and other people just are slothful. I think one of the greatest lines I ever heard, after I was sober about 2 weeks. I was sitting around the club one night and the guy had a couple other guys. He took us up to his apartment in Beverly Hills. But there's a program on about alcoholism. I thought you guys would like to see it. And oh, Jesus. Yeah. See a program on alcoholism? There weren't many of them, but they were bad then, too. But they had this Playhouse 90 show about alcoholism. It's called Days of Wine and Roses. It came out in 1958. And I watched that, and the guy watched him become a drunk. Then I watched him marry this girl, and then watched her become a drunk. And then he got sober and went to AA, and then he talked to her, and she was going to AA. Just another smarmy, goddamn weird ending. That, you know what helped me in that? When the girl said the deathless line to him, he was now living in the little apartment with his daughter, because she was an unfit mother, she's on the streets drinking, and she came to visit her daughter, and he said, the daughter's in bed now, can't you stay sober? Won't you go to AA with me? It'll get better. She said, you just don't understand, and you never will. And she walked with him over the window, went to the alley down there, said, look, see that alley? It's dirty and full of garbage, and there's some dreadful, dirty mud puddles. I can't stand ugliness. When I drink, I don't see the garbage. I just see the reflections in the water. And things must be beautiful. And she went out to drink and apparently to die. And somehow, that was more impressive to me than any lecture I ever saw. I understood what she was saying, but for the first time, I could identify the feeling and I could see it objectively. Not as the one reacting, but see, oh, that's what it is. That's what I feel. That's what I see. And I walked out of there much strengthened. I was pleased a year or two ago. A guy in our group directed that Playhouse 90, and he gave me a kinescope of that show. And it's all kind of gray and fluttery, but it really is kind of touching, because, you know, those were done live, and there was no rehearsals in there. It was really, you could see, you could hear the thump of sets being changed and all. But at that moment, it was just as golden as it could be. But how do you get to the point of understanding that there's a name for this type of emotion? Nearly all of my life, I have been finding a way, trying to find a way to redress the feelings I have that seem to be different. And I've spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis, and I've spent a lot of money into metaphysics, and I've read books, I've done a lot of things. But when I was a boy, 15 years old, on a ship in Pearl Harbor, early in the Second World War, I made a discovery that was absolutely unusual. And I didn't know it was unusual until after I saw that Playhouse 90 show many years later. What was unusual about it is that it did something for me I didn't expect. At the time, I didn't know it was unusual. Because as I often say, as you grow up, you find out things. You discover things. You find things that are good, you find things that are bad. You've heard about things, you try them. That's part of growing up, in your teens especially. You know, you find out eventually that your parents won't support you anymore. That's bad news. You find out that there are days when people won't bail you out. That's bad news. You find sex. That's good news. That's a pleasant thing. You find out that sex brings babies. That's a bad thing. You find all sorts of things that come and go. You find that people are not the way they look. You find that alcohol makes you feel better. There's nothing wrong with that. Because you have no way of measuring it, nor does anybody in this room ever have any way of measuring it. You have to find out from others that alcohol should not make you feel that good. That is the unusual reaction. Alcohol should not make you feel that good. But who would ever know that? Now, as I've said, again, used as an illustration, it's the best way now to put it. A couple of years ago, I was speaking at a meeting, and a very beautiful, lovely, talented, gorgeous movie star getting her 8th birthday cake. And she gets $100,000 a week in Vegas for dancing, and she goes back here and she does dramatic roles. It's just wonderful. And she's so beautiful. She's in her 40s now, but she looks like about 22. You wonder, why would such a person drink? And she was giving her little birthday talk, and she was explaining that when she was younger, people thought she was glamorous and lovely and wonderful and sexy. But she felt awkward and clumsy and unattractive. And she found out when she was a young woman that a few drinks made her feel the way people saw her. And it saved her career. And she drank, and she had to drink more, and eventually lose control. And then it almost cost her her life. And it almost cost her her career. And she was saved from that by Alcoholics Anonymous. Now she's getting her 8th birthday cake. But she had received, without her knowing it, she'd received an unusual reaction from alcohol. Alcohol shouldn't, on a continuing basis, make you feel more attractive and more lovely. It should just deaden conflict a little bit. Most of us know Keith Seal used to play center for the San Francisco 49ers. He talks about he and one of the guards out of the whole team would have to get back to the dressing room before the game and have a pint. Because until he had that, he didn't think he could block Joe Schmidt, that linebacker. But once he got that pint, he could knock them all on their tail. He didn't know that there was an unusual reaction. I didn't know on that ship that I had received an unusual reaction. The reason I took the drink, because I was desperate to look like a man to these men on that ship. They treated me like a punk, and I thought if I could drink like a man, I'd look like a man. And instead of making me look like a man, it made me do something much more complex. It made me feel the way men look. Now that sounds the same almost, but it's 180 degrees difference. And I had no idea that it was an unusual reaction. It wasn't for years later I found out men don't feel as well as they look. So I was feeling better than they were. But who would know that? It was just like finding, and I didn't ever think much about it, drinking is drinking. And I drank from then on. I became a terrible old drunkard. I learned to try to drink wisely and well and try to feel like a man and try to do what men do and try to, as I got into advertising and public relations, many years later, I got myself to like martinis and like sophisticated things so I'd be slick. And I always drank, and drinking always helped me. And the only problem, to me, again, the best way to describe it, drinking, to me, was very similar to modern man's attempts to harness atomic energy. Nothing works better than atomic energy. Nothing works better than atomic energy. It's just every so often, something bad happens. Nothing in my life has ever worked better than alcohol. Ever has. It's just every so often, something bad happens. And you're always rechecking the gauges next time. Let's see now. When did that meltdown start? And just when you're doing good, you look over and you see a mushroom-shaped cloud. Or it's a black and white. They're both the same. But alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I think about it tonight. Tonight we stopped by the mission. We have a little custom that I do down there. It's the only place in the world that does it, but it brings me a great deal of cheer. The people who sleep there tonight, I go in there. Usually it's on Christmas Eve. Maybe we can have a little more time. But today, I just stopped on the way out here. And I get a list of their names as they sign in to go upstairs. And they're all on the street, cold and wet. And I take an envelope and I put their name on it. We had some friends help me tonight. And then put a card in there with a little note to them personally and stick in some dough and seal it. So they get up in the morning, they're the only people getting up on Skid Row, I'll tell you, with a Christmas card with their name on it and a little dough. And we're watching the people in the doorway, and there's a lot of people that can't get in. And to tell you what it's like on Skid Row, this morning they were telling us the people were lining up at 2 o'clock this morning to get in tonight. So they wouldn't have to be on the street on Christmas Eve. But they're standing there drinking and raising hell and wondering why this doesn't go on. And I stopped briefly to talk to the guys and, this is a hell of a way to live. I used to be on the street. Would you like to try a different way? And he just told me to get effed. And he was a tough cookie. And somebody else in the rush said, you shouldn't say that to the boss, man. But I understand exactly how he felt. Because once that facade slips, you're helpless. You better have anything you got going for you. And as long as you have the best example I know of that feeling is that old Skid Row story about the guy sitting in the gutter in a night like this, cold and rainy, and his life is a shambles. He's sick and come off of drunk, and everything is gone. His family's discouraged. And a little sheet of paper. I might as well be dead. I should let my dad know I died, because he always loved me. And he said this, dear dad, I am here in Los Angeles. And he felt a thump in his foot, and coming down the dirty gutter, floating along, is a bottle, and he picks it up, and it's half full of wine. And if there's anything you ever need, you let me know. As far as I know, that's as good a description of the disease of alcoholism as there is extant. Nothing. It's hard to explain. Nothing that I know of in my life has ever brought me momentary omnipotence. Just boom. And when you spend all of your life sober, feeling strange and like a whip and put upon and being screwed around and feeling too emotional and feeling you got holes all over you in your emotions, and you discover that a few drinks makes them full, and then sometimes you drink too much and get in trouble, the natural corollary is I'm going to find a way so I don't do it too much. I'm going to do it as long and make it the way it should be. Because it never struck me what I drank. It was making me feel so different than other people felt. I always thought all my life it was just bringing me up to where they'd been all along. They've been here all along, and I haven't been, and I don't know why. And my psychiatrist doesn't know why. He blames it on my childhood. And my metaphysician blames it on my relationship to the universe. And my studies of Nietzsche blame it on my feelings of superiority, inferiority that's complex. And my readings tell me all sorts of things. But I don't care. When the time comes that old Frank Sinatra song says, I just want to get through the night. I just want to get through the night, and I'll watch it. And then his wife got you shy. When you feel good and things are different and you feel a little expansive, and all of a sudden there's the black and white again. And you said, I didn't mean it. I didn't mean any trouble. I didn't mean to get into a fight on the street corner with some puke. I didn't mean to drive badly. I didn't mean to do anything. All I meant to do was feel like everybody else. Then you're sorry. And I've been sorry a lot. Probably the sorriest, one of the sorrier feelings I've ever, the sorriest I've ever been. The very, that happened right around Christmas too. Week before Christmas, 1950. And I was in jail after being drunk all night. And we had to fight with the cops somewhere. They took me in. No big deal. But my father came down and saw me at 6 o'clock in the morning. He had never done that. He had always been so ashamed of me being in jail. And he came down and thought, isn't that touching? For once, maybe my dad's going to help me in a deal like that. He said, did you have a good time last night, son? I said, no, I didn't, Dad. But I'm going to do better. He said, I hope you had a wonderful time. Because while you were drunk, you let your little son die at home. He said, I don't ever want to talk to you again. And we went. And I was so sorry I couldn't stand it. I almost went crazy. The judge let me out. He was a friend. Her family. He let me out. And it was terrible. I went to court that morning to talk to him. And he released me. I said, oh, judge, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And he said something I didn't understand for years after that. And I went back and saw him 20 years ago and told him, I now understand. He said, I'm sorry, Clancy. You are too sorry. I said, what do you mean to? How could you be too sorry? He said, I have a feeling that you're not only sorry for what's happened, but that you're sorry that it may very well happen again. You're crazy. You're crazy. But later on, I looked at that. I'm sure that was part of it. Because when you don't have, when things just happen, you don't mean for them to happen. How can you control it? How can you do anything? And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, stop drinking. And there's no way to explain to them. When I stop drinking, that's when I feel bad. That stuff helps me. And I don't know what to do. And I try to get a better job. And I try to do more. And I try to do things. And the past haunts me. And I lived in a different city where I got successful for a while. And then I did something so bad to my best friend that he went home and committed suicide. Probably not entirely my fault, but I thought it was. And I left and I ran and always this terrible dichotomy. Some part of me who insists on being good and being something, and some part of me says you're a failure and you're a loser. And you see that pattern again and again in alcoholics. Maybe not quite so dramatic, but of all the fifth steps I've ever heard, it's almost always there. It's almost that there's a low-lying sense of unworth, lack of self-worth, that makes it necessary, just as you start to succeed, to somehow screw it up. Almost as though a little voice says, you don't deserve it, you rotten son of a bitch. You don't deserve it. And the party says, I know it. And away it goes. Now, that's a continuing battle, and you never even are aware of it. It just seems like there's an endless series of bad breaks and misunderstandings till one day you get knocked down one more time and you can't get up. You can't get up because there's no sense getting up. Why get your hopes up again? Why hang around AA again? Oh, when you get sober, it's going to be wonderful. When I get sober, I'm going to commit suicide. That's all. That's why I was in the insane asylum in Texas. I stayed sober too long in one of my fits of do-gooderism, and one day I could not stand it. Because my wife was pregnant, and I was trying to stay sober for the birth of that child so I wouldn't kill another one, as I thought to myself. And I stayed sober so long I couldn't stand it. One day, they were in church, and I just pulled the car in the garage and pulled the hose on. I couldn't drink. So I decided to die. What do you do when you're like that? Work a few steps, go to some meetings. That doesn't get it. There's something terribly wrong. That's why, in a sense, I probably was more comfortable Christmas 1958 sitting in Tanner's than maybe I had been for 20 years. I didn't have to be anything anymore. I could just be what I was, a nothing, a no good, a phony, a liar. And I didn't like that. And the next morning, when people treated me badly, I felt resentful. But somehow down deep in me, there's almost a cosmic payoff. You don't deserve it. And I know. And that's why it's amazing that somehow I was interested in staying sober at the Canada's Delicatessen. And the next day I went to the noon meeting and the night meeting. And the next day I stayed sober. The next day I got stayed sober and had a little job finally and lost it again. And somehow 30 years have gone by. And the only difference in my life, really, is that I have found over a period of time a slow and sometimes frustrating way to deal with the very problems that only alcohol has ever touched in my life. In order to understand this, somewhere along the line, two things had to be necessary. Vince talks about it sometimes, he did the other night. You can be this way sleeping in an abandoned car, or you could be this way driving a Rolls Royce down the road. I watch people that way the same way. You must achieve a state of desperation. You must get to the point that you cannot think of what would appear to be a viable solution. You know, that's what saved the man who kind of helped start AA. He didn't really start AA, but Roland. He had to talk about the book. He went to send to Dr. Jung, and he treated him for a year, and he got out, and he got drunk, and he went back. And Dr. Jung said, I can't treat you anymore. You're an alcoholic. I just discovered that. I thought you were emotionally sick, but you're an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no treatment that will work for you in the world today. And that was in 1932. The best doctor in the world had never heard of a treatment. No. But Roland thought, well, what does this mean? What does this mean I have to do, doctor? And the doctor says, I'll tell you what it means. You must keep yourself voluntarily or involuntarily confined as long as you live, or certainly you will intermittently drink alcohol until you die or go mad. And Roland said, that's the only alternative. That's all I've ever heard of. So once in 5 million, maybe someone will have an intense emotional relocation. They call it a spiritual experience. He said, but your chances of being hit by lightning are better than the spiritual experience. Now, what saved Roland? You know what saved Roland? This time he didn't get drunk. He got on the ship and he came home. And he believed the doctor. On that ship, he surrendered to the fact he had no alternative. And he stayed sober. And as we know, he went to the Oxford Group and finally befriended a man in Vermont named Ebbie Thatcher, born in New York. Ebbie Thatcher remembered his old pal in Brooklyn, the drunken bum, Bill Wilson. And so the chain started that brought us here tonight. But another funny thing about Ebbie, he never went to AA. He went to the Oxford Group. And as the years went by, Bill was kind of frustrated about it. I'll tell you an interesting fact that maybe you've never heard. And very few people have ever heard this touching little anecdote. By 1940, Roland had become kind of a cross patch that people didn't like much. In 1943, Roland died. To this day, his family has always refused to give the cause of death, which led nearly everyone to believe he went back to drinking and died drunk.
And you make a difference how dedicated you were, how surrendered you were, if you don't do something to maintain it. But nobody, I'm not saying it, Roland died drunk. It's a very, very strange thing. And his family would categorically refuse to give the cause of death. You and I struggled through it in our early days. But what does Alcoholics Anonymous do? It gets you to stop drinking. And you got to surrender, and you got to be desperate, and accept the fact, I don't know what the hell to do. In fact, one of the greatest enemies of sobriety is when you're sober a short time and things start to work out a little bit and the feeling of desperation goes away. More people have been lost in than by anything else. They have to come back again usually. But feeling a little touch of comfort, feeling a little touch of the heat is off, takes away one element that is very helpful. And that is, I don't know what to do, therefore I will let them tell me what to do, even though if I knew what to do, I wouldn't let them tell me what to do. Desperation. It has been said many, many times, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is predicated on. It isn't predicated on meetings. It isn't predicated on reading the book. All these are nice things, but there was Alcoholics Anonymous long before any of these things ever took place. There weren't AA meetings for several years. There was a book for over 3 years. In fact, as some of you know, this year is the 50th anniversary of the writing of this book. It wasn't published until 1939. So for 3.5 or 4 years, there wasn't any book. There weren't any meetings as such, offhand meetings. There wasn't any conventions. There weren't any GSRs. There weren't any secretaries. There weren't any parties. There weren't any anything. What they had was the very thing we have today, which gets lost in all the panoply that surrounds us. AA's become a wonderful place. A couple weeks ago, what was it, Newsweek, some jerk, wrote an essay about how the in thing in Hollywood is called a Star School AA because it's so much fun. Great. If they come around the Pacific group, they won't think as much fun. Oddly enough, we have one of those guys in the Pacific group, and he's been, he hasn't been told yet that he has to be treated like a star. So it'd be fun to see him out with a shovel this morning, following that horse, and knowing that someday his agent would get 10% of all that. But what is it AA is? It happened to me in 1958, happens to you, happens to all of us, little by little, somewhere along the line, and sometimes it gets lost in all the obfuscation that makes AA a more attractive place. Do you know what it is? You know what Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob had that you and I have in common? It is this message of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. That's all it is. And those actions may vary. Eventually the actions get to be the steps. The actions get to be involvement. But it's always the same. We come here sharing something. Terrible feelings of difference. Sometimes superiority to those people. Sometimes inferiority to those people. But certainly always apart from. And knowing that my difference is predicated on the fact that my problem really isn't alcohol. If these emotional problems and these wants and these needs and these yearnings of mine could be satisfied, and they're not too much, just let me feel like other people, for Christ's sake. But you don't understand. You see, there's... my case is different. And you hear people get up and say at meetings, we all laugh. And they think they really are different because we don't understand that they are different. They don't understand that we're laughing because we know that feeling so well. Identification. And we stay here long enough and we take actions, little by little. We, sometimes if we're lucky, we have sponsors who intimidate us a little bit so we don't overrule them every soon as they're out of sight. That the fear of their wrath is more sensitive than the fear of drinking. I'd like to drink, but that sound makes you go crazy. And then have them get a little bit better, so they say, "You can't hurt me anymore." And go off and become sponsors of their own and intimidate their baby. And the purpose of this is so we can get together and learn to understand that what we have is a twofold illness, just as they say in all these meetings. But it's not the twofold I would have thought. It turns out I have a mental obsession, they call it. Obsession may not be a word you like, but obsession is basically what it is. Little by little, we take human emotions and blow them out of perspective until they become obsessions. What obsessions are is emotions that have been inflated a lot. So they put out. There's a phrase in chapter 3 that certainly describes one of the great obsessions you and I will ever have. If you're new to that, you may wonder, what do you have in common with all these people? Certainly not your age, all ages here. Not your size, not your color, not your religion, not how much you drank. You discover everybody drinks differently. Everybody just does different things. The only thing I ever found that is, I believe everyone in AA has had when they came in the door, or before they came in the door, that one little sentence mentioned in chapter 3. We have all at one time or another, without being aware of it, been forced into an obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says in our book, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And to all non-alcoholics in the world, it is absolutely inexplicable why anyone would have such a stinking obsession. Why do you have such an obsession to drink when it's killing you, for Christ's sake? Set it down. You're ruining your children, you're ruining your family, you're ruining your life. Why do you have to find it necessary to find a way to drink? There's like a hideous illustration in the book. I guess it's accurate, but it's hideous about that jaywalker. Oh, dear. Now, if I'd have written that book, I'd have said, but that really is true. And that's, we don't understand it ourselves. You understand it, why you do it? I bet you don't. I'll tell you why you have that obsession. Because one of the problems, one of the twofold problems, you say a spiritual problem, that may be true, but as far as the getting sober, it's a bifold problem. One of the problems is an obsession of the mind, an obsession that you can control and enjoy your drinking, obsessions that deal with all sorts of emotions, resentments, loves, hatreds, failures, everything is out of whack. Everything is out of perspective. It's like taking a color TV set, turning the color knob all the way over. The colors just are not real anymore. They're just so intense, so vivid. Now, how do you beat that? Well, you tone it down. There's no knob to tone it down. You live in a world of obsessive reactions. That's one of the folds. The second fold is that the man that named it years and years ago called it an allergy of the body. And we hear that. What's an allergy of the body? Every time you drink, you get drunk. Every time you drink, you go crazy. That doesn't happen to me. He sometime later wrote an addition. He said, if I were to describe, but when I gathered in alcohol, watching alcoholics, he was not an alcoholic, but listening to Bill Wilson and the fellows, he said, I would not call it an allergy. I would call it, it's closer to a sensitivity of the body, but I don't know how to explain it. But we know how to explain it, because we've had years of further knowledge in hindsight. Alcohol has an unusual reaction on my body. It makes an unbalanced emotional life balance. The thing that makes an alcoholic are not those emotions, although they come with alcoholism, they are not what cause an alcoholic. Because there are millions of people who have all the emotions you and I have who are not alcoholics. They are known medically as intense or acute neurotics. They live in reality, they see reality, but they react obsessively, badly, emotionally, intensely. Those are the people for whom Valium was invented. And that, no joke, that's what it's for. For people who have no relief. And if they can slow them down, they snap and become psychotic. And once you become psychotic, you stay that way. That's what all of these downers are for. That's why the doctors deal with them. Take this. Better than to shake yourself to pieces. But people like you and me can't even do that. Why? Because we have a system that is ultra-responsive to chemical correction. What makes an alcoholic? Alcohol has to make you feel all right. It must make you feel, it must fill holes that by nature cannot be filled chemically. Alcohol has to do something for me it doesn't do for 95% of the people who drink. And I never knew it, and I'm sure you never knew it. You have no way of knowing it. Standing at a bar, drinking with a couple guys, having a drink, talking over a football game. Wasn't that something about the Browns? Lost the screw out of the touchdown today. Terrible. I just have to feel at one with them. And they say, well, Betty's got dinner on. See you later. And it's just like, where's your piece of your life going? Mussy. Give us another one. I'll wait for the night crowd. I've been in a thousand times. Go down to the bar on Saturday morning, be with my friends, and all of a sudden find myself drunk, and I better go home and go to bed. But it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and the sun's up there. Oh, Jesus. All you can do then is go vomit somewhere, so you can have some fun later. Come on. All I want to do is feel good. Just feel like things. And it's out of control. And they want me to stop. And then I stop, I feel bad. And I get crazy, and the emotions come back, and the feeling. I can sit in a big office, I'm supposed to be hot shot, and just think, I want to jump right out the window. And when I have a few drinks, I feel good. And now drinking's out of hand, sobriety's untenable. I would be the last one in the world to understand the name for that condition is alcoholism. And it means, doesn't mean how often you get drunk, whether you've been in jail, nothing to do with it. What it means is this. Sobriety has become untenable. Drinking has become untenable. And you have fallen into a little category now that about 95 to 5, your chances are that you will die from it like Roland died from it. Either insane or just die. It's hard to think. You know, I'm a very good communicator. I go all over the world and talk this year. I've been in talking all over New Zealand and England and Scotland and Ireland and a lot of places. In fact, one of the towns I was in was this little Lockerbie where this plane crashed. But I have been, you know, I'm a communicator. You'd think I could stand in front of the midnight mission to a guy dying in the cold and communicate there's a way to get better. Come on with us to the meeting. But there's no communication there because the answer is always the same. I know you mean well, baby, but my case is different. And that's what's got to be smashed. And people die before they get desperate enough. You and I, somewhere along the line, have become desperate enough. We've been driven here. Now, after we get here, we have to learn that there's nothing you or I will ever do about drinking to make it tolerable again. If drinking could become tolerable again, that's why they say in this book, science may one day find an answer, but it has not done so yet. The only answer science could do, so think about it, they could make you take a pill or something that would not make alcohol do what it's supposed to do what it does for other people. Who the hell would want to drink it then? I drink it because it goes boom. You with anyone, Granny? It turns out what happens to an alcoholic, alcohol has the power to alter my perception of reality. And you never know it, and you have to work on it, you have to be desperate and take steps and allow yourself to be bully-ragged and hurt and traduced and lonely and sad and put upon for a long time. And one day you can look back and say, that's what I had. And go out and talk about it. But when you're going through it, you don't know it. All you know is, I got to keep going somehow. But sobriety can get very bad. Sometimes people say, AA doesn't work. I have terrible emotional problems. But you've got to remember, pal, that's the natural state of sober alcoholics. The natural state of sober alcoholics is depression, growing anxiety, and tension. When you have a terrible depression, that's just a preview of coming attractions of how your life is going to be forever. That should give you a little hope. Wow. I had a wonderful sneak preview this morning. That's what AA is about. AA is not to get you sober. I found that out long after I was sober. It's not to get you sober, not to make you holy, not to make you wonderful. Because no matter how long you stay, you'll be flawed and make mistakes, hurt your friends, do all sorts of things, intentionally or unintentionally. It doesn't make a difference. Human beings are human beings. The point remains that Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to little by little fill holes in people like you and me that nothing else except alcohol has ever touched. And if you disbelieve that, you look around you. I can look from where I'm sitting now. I can see people off Skid Row. I can see people off Beverly Hills. I can see people off Bel Air. I can see people all kinds of people. And every one of them thought they were as different as you are. And the funny thing about alcoholism is this. If I don't take care of myself, if I allow myself to get fall into this, for example, when you're sober a long time, that's what that's for. Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. They don't make me drunk. They make me feel different. They make me feel angry. They make me, when I'm hungry, I don't know why, I stay the same. People get stupid around me. Slow and stupid. I saw it in a restaurant on Lincoln Boulevard today, and I swear it's true. She was good, slow and stupid, and I was hungry. I said, I want some hot cake. I said, I don't want to hear that AA shit. She is slow. When I get angry, people need to be disciplined. It's not easy being the group conscience for everybody. I sometimes just wish I had just a small Pershing tank on that Santa Monica freeway. You want to drive like that, son of a bitch? What do you think of that? Yeah. I think God wants me to kill certain people. Now.
Thy will be done, Father.
That's why I don't own a gun, because the day might come where I might hear the message. When I get lonely, I know that everybody's having a good time. Just like tonight, if I were lonely, I'm not. If I were, I'd know that everybody that I didn't know, that I didn't see, was sitting around a Christmas tree getting presents out of one, singing carols, and their grandmother and their Aunt Alma was there with them. When I'm lonely, I just feel so sad. When I'm tired, I just kind of want to die usually. You know, just when I'm tired, I want to quit my job. When I'm tired, people are crazy. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Think good things to keep from me. And it's almost embarrassing. I'd almost rather have the pain than have it corrected by such a simple manner as eating. Well, that hurts my pride. But here we are. That's where we wind up. And the reason that's important to remember is this. It's Christmas Eve tonight. Christmas is a vast, wonderful, emotional binge. But you and I cannot afford emotional binges, even if they're wonderful. Christmas, I've said this many, many times, still believe it. Christmas is the day I give to them. Today in my house tonight, I got all my grandchildren there, little ones, ones in college. I have children, sons-in-laws. Christ, if you want to see a mark of a hunted lion, look for me home tonight looking for a place to lay down in. No beds, no floors, no nothing. Just going over to Canner's Delicatessen. But I give them that day. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to work, and I'm glad I got the midnight vision. I'll serve over 3,000 meals tomorrow, and I'll be so busy I won't even think about it. And wish them all a Merry Christmas. But in my mind, Christmas is their day. I got 364 other days that I live for, too. That's why we're running a little late tonight. I always say, I didn't come out here on Christmas Eve to wish you Merry Christmas. You can hear that anywhere. I didn't come out here to wish you a Happy New Year. You can hear that anyplace. I think we got to tell each other and ourselves tonight, again for the 29th year, I guess, I wish you a very Merry March 16th and a happy and prosperous June. And I hope October will bring pleasant things to your house. But most importantly, to remember, this is not a game where we work ourselves in and out. Like Dr. Jung told Roland, you have three chances. You can either keep yourself voluntarily or involuntarily confined till you die, because we don't want to do that, or you must certainly intermittently drink until you die or go mad. And that's not much of an alternative. But the third one turned out to be a winner. We know now that with 12 steps and actions and involvements and people and listening and doing, we can effect, to all intents and purposes, a spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his, but the way you and I get ours, step by step by step. Something unheard of before AA, an incremental spiritual experience. And that's what we have to maintain, and that's why we're here. I'm glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. I hope that you have all the pleasures of the season in May and November and all the days that we stand up and say, my name is Clancy, or whatever it might be. I'm an alcoholic, and through the grace of God and the power of 12 steps, I need never be insane again. Have a good day.